Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado. No wonder Chevy Silverado is the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
This week, the Rascals mints about Anthony Weiner's problem, Trump's Mexico trip, and Chicago's gun violence.
Today is Friday, September 2nd, 2016. This is John Williams. You're listening to The Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast, part of which you can hear on my Saturday show at 1:30 here on WGN.
I'm Steve Bertrand, host of The Business Lunch on WGN Radio.
I'm Eric Zorn, the gifted columnist from The Tribune, who appears Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays in the paper.
Kristen McQuarrie cannot join us today. She's working rather than playing with the Rascals.
She gave me her proxy on the way up here to the studio. I said, can I speak on your behalf today? And she laughed and said, oh, sure.
Yeah, she laughed all right. Let's start with, I want to do it chronologically. You know, the big stories remain Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in the campaigns. But we could tie these things together if we began with the Anthony Weiner story. It was announced this week that he is sexting again and that his wife Uma Abedin, Hillary's right-hand woman, is now going to leave him. They may have been separated for a while anyway, but she is no longer with Anthony and she's with the campaign. I said that Hillary had to do one of two things, right? She either had to get rid of Uma or Uma had to get rid of Anthony. I also just wonder about the compulsion people have for self-destruction. What is it that drives this guy to do this sort of thing to himself? I don't know if either of you are a psychologist, but what's your thought about that story this week?
Well, you know, I had some reservations about his status as a private citizen and the outing of him in this area. I mean, he's no longer a congressman. He's no longer a mayoral candidate. The last two times that these stories came up about his sexting activity, he was a public figure. Now he's a stay-at-home dad. Who happens to be married to a woman who is not an elected official but a top aide to Hillary Clinton. It just the relevance of it doesn't seem all that strong. So I have that reservation. That said, it is baffling to me that someone with this problem can't rein it in. I mean, I understand chemical addiction, but I don't understand this compulsion to engage in this self-destructive behavior that's just, I mean, he's cost himself everything. This guy was a rising talent in the Democratic Party. He has lost everything now. He's lost everything but his cell phone, I guess.
Well, I think it would have been a story with or without Huma, though, because there's a guy who's a former congressman, at one time thought to be the heir apparent to Michael Bloomberg. So I think it would have been news, especially in New York, either way. As for understanding it, you know, I just think we can't get inside other people's brains. And clearly, I think he would probably stop it if he thought he could. And for some reason, he can't.
I had a sex therapist on the show to talk a little bit about that, Steve. And I thought she was going to reinforce that, say it's like an addiction and some people can't seem to help them. It's the only way to explain these sort of self-destructive behaviors. And she said, no, this guy just made reckless choices. He doesn't want to be monogamous, and he likes to do this, and it's all on him. She just said, you know, what a creep, what a jerk. She wasn't, you know,
really
throwing him any sympathy at all. I mean, she's not the last psychologist or sex therapist on earth, but that's at least what one of them said.
I guess this is just a form of adultery, right? I mean, it's a form of it's emotional betrayal. It's not, I guess, he's not literally making physical contact with these women, but he is emotionally betraying his wife.
Betraying his wife.
And we don't ask the question of people who are serial adulterers why they keep doing it. I guess maybe we understand that better than we understand this. But boy, it's one of those things where you just think, boy, you know, you this exact problem is what has cost you everything that you have, and now you're going to get rid of the last things that you have by doing it again. I don't.
It was made worse too by the fact that his son was in the bed with him when he sent that one unfortunate picture. That was, I think, that made it even creepier for a lot of people. And if I may, Eric, the other thing that just kind of confounds me is Uma Abedin. I mean, isn't it interesting to me? I think people are so complicated, and we don't have a clue how they really are wired or operate. But how could somebody who seems to be so smooth and smart be marry to this guy to begin with and then stay with him through strike two, you know?
Well, a couple of things. I mean,
explain that to me.
Have you seen the documentary Wiener yet?
A friend of mine has, no.
It's an excellent film, and it was obviously shot before this latest incident.
Well, during his run for mayor.
But it was shot during his run for mayor, and you watch Huma, who seems to be keeping her distance from him in a lot of ways during the entire course of the movie as it goes along. She's not warm to him. But I think there is this sense that you can also see in this film what is it that attracts people or attracted people to him. I mean, he's very smart, very confident. He's extremely well spoken. He had some stuff going on, is what I'm saying. And I think that she probably saw that. And I'm guessing that she stuck with him probably because they have a child together.
Mm-hmm. And there was reporting, I don't know how stuck with him she was, that they've been pretty much living separate lives for a while anyway, that this announcement just came, but it was just confirming what was already reality.
But do you see this, Steve, as a political story? Is there any vote that's going to change because...
Oh, this is a huge political story.
But
yeah,
why?
I can't.
But why?
Because his wife is Hillary, will be the chief of staff if Hillary Clinton gets elected. Don't you think that's a problem for the administration to have that live wire? And by the way, the person that he was texting with or sexting with was, or was it on Twitter for that matter? Yeah, it was on Twitter, tweeting with. It's even worse. That person was a person who isn't going to vote for Hillary Clinton at all. Had ties to the NRA and the Republican Party.
There is no suggestion that he was exchanging policy information.
Well, there is that suggestion, very strong suggestion, but it's made by one guy. It's made by Donald Trump. I mean,
well, what do you think that Huma and her husband talk about?
I don't think they talk at all. I don't think they were having dinner together at all.
You don't? Okay, but do you see the point that as long as you're married to that guy, as long as you're sharing rides to the kids' play together, that sort of thing can come up in conversation, and Anthony Weiner can't be trusted with that. I absolutely think they need to divorce.
I don't see any evidence that this goes beyond the boundaries of his sexual predilection. That he's saying, you know, honey, tell me what you're wearing, and I'll tell you what Huma told me about our secret meetings with the former Secretary of State. I mean, I don't imagine that's going to be happening. And I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine anyone holding that. It's like people trying to hold Bill Clinton against Hillary Clinton. At some point, you feel like, wait a minute, let's talk about who the candidate is and what his or her positions are. Let's not, you know, take several steps removed. It's like the people who want to use Donald Trump's son's big game hunting in Africa against Donald Trump. Well, you know, I just think like that is just not. It is so far from the issues that people care about, or that's going to make any difference. So,
well, then let's talk about one of those. Donald Trump was in Mexico, Eric. Was that a good play by Donald Trump?
It was very strange because he went. He was almost sedated when he was in Mexico. From the footage that I saw from the news conference that he held with the president of Mexico afterwards, he looked. Presidential, frankly, there.
Oh,
and well,
go ahead.
And,
I think it was
well,
Margarita, didn't it?
Well,
Margarita.
Oh, it's Donald Trump, child actor.
Well,
that's
no.
He thinks a president looks like.
So, well, Eric, we asked your opinion, but we don't really want it.
Let me
just add this one thought, which is he goes there, and he gets a pretty good press pop for it, and then it takes him 4 hours. He does this on the same day that he's going to give this speech in Arizona. And so there's no time for that story to breathe. There's no time for that story to get out there, to make an impression on people, to sit there. He stamps on it immediately with his very harsh immigration speech. So, I don't know. It was a good move to go? Yes, it was a good move for him to go. I think it was smart of him. I don't know why the president of Mexico invited him to come down or why he agreed to receive him at this point, but the trip to Mexico, yes.
Peña Nieto could have ended his campaign, could have ended Donald Trump's campaign, had he just said, after Donald Trump said we didn't discuss the wall, that he just said at that event, I told him I wasn't going to pay for it.
Wait a minute. I wish to differ with my friend from Manhattan.
And, you know, now they're saying technically, well, they didn't discuss it. Peña Nieto said he wasn't going to pay for it, and apparently then it was Giuliani who said, hey, that's off the table, and then they moved on. But had Pena, had the president said right then that we did, I did bring it up and I told him.
But he did say that, Steve.
He said it in a tweet later after Donald Trump said at the event in front of all these reporters that it wasn't discussed.
Oh, I see. So all the cameras are clicking away.
He should have said, oh, yes, we did. Oh, yes, we did talk about it and I told you I wasn't going to pay for it. Yeah. That would have, you know, just eviscerated Trump.
And this failure is baffling observers in Mexico because Pena's got a approval rating that's way down there.
It's in the 20s, I think.
It's in the Mike Madigan range.
In fact, well, Trump's, yeah. Never mind.
Yeah, I know, really. So there was another very unpopular candidate or politician. I didn't see the upside in it. I thought, well, Trump's already, you know, said tough things about his immigration plan. If he goes down there to try and sort of moderate that, then I think that alienates the base. So I thought, I don't know that that's a good idea, particularly since you're not going to persuade this guy of anything. Maybe that's what presidential candidates do. They go talk to other world leaders. But I thought if he looks soft, then I think that hurts his stance. And then he came back in Phoenix and gave that speech you were talking about, Eric. And that was the real Donald Trump again. And the crowd on that was salivating. I mean, oh my God, did he have those people whipped up into a frenzy when he says, the first day I'm in office, we're throwing them out. We're going to get them. You could see the torches and pitchforks.
It was like two campaigns. I don't understand.
Really?
That.
Yeah.
I heard all that in his speech. And I my column on this, which I think ran today, I write these things and then they go into they go online and I never know when they're going to show up in the paper.
Right.
But my point about this speech is, yeah, he threw a lot of red meat, but it was all focused on criminals.
Right.
It was all he gave five examples right at the top of that speech of innocent American citizens minding their own business who were brutally murdered by people who are in this country illegally.
Yeah.
And the whole speech spun out of that all of his points were basically the ways that he is going to get rid of this criminal element it's part of a law and order thing. It was toward the end of the speech, after he delivered his 10 fantasies that he has, that he did this, what I consider to be a tap dance or a pivot around this issue of what do you do with the vast majority of people who are in this country without permission, undocumented immigrants, who are following the law, they're working, they're raising, they're paying taxes, they're raising children, they are not criminals. What do you do with them? And these are the people who, this is the issue that this whole immigration debate turns on, and the thing that seems to enrage the base is this idea that we're not going to kick those people out, that we're going to give them a path to legalization.
Them too.
It wasn't a tap dance. It wasn't a pivot. It was a punt.
Punted. He said, well, after we get, after we build our wall, after we control all of illegal immigration, after illegal immigration is a distant memory in the past, then we'll deal with this basically the 95% or whatever of these immigrants who are here illegally who are not a problem.
Then we'll take on the hard question.
So if you want to summarize that, the question is we're never going to deal with those people because we're never going to get a total handle on illegal immigration. It's not going to happen.
Two things I've heard others say, and I think the sanctuary city might be an exception to it, but by and large he reiterated Barack Obama's immigration policy.
For the most part, yeah. I mean, the Obama administration and the policy of ICE and all these places is to focus on criminal aliens. They want to kick out people who are committing crimes. They're not going to go around and they're going to get a house painter and they're going to pull him over and take him, put him on a bus and send him out of the country. Not going to happen.
The other thing was, he keeps saying now that he and the Mexican president agreed that they need to stop the flow of drugs and people and guns across the border. Well, Nieto was talking not about guns from Mexico coming to the U.S., but about guns from the U.S. going to Mexico. And Trump's using that rhetoric as if the guns are a threat to us here in the States. Nieto's point was that those guns are a threat to Mexicans coming from here in the United States.
Well, I think there's two ways to sell the wall. One is that we need to build a wall, and we're going to throw the bums on the other side of it, and they're not getting over here, and they're going to pay for it. The other way to sell the concept, and he mentioned this in that speech they wrote for him after he visited with the president down there, is that human trafficking is bad for both sides, right? We don't want them coming over here and the things they have to go through to get here, you know, giving up their family savings and maybe surviving those perilous journeys. Human trafficking across the line or that sort of illegal immigration is bad for Mexicans too. So let's sort of build a wall to keep that from happening. You know, you could shrug and say, well, maybe he has a point there. He did say that, but then, you know, sort of eviscerated that point when he just got in front of the maddening crowd in Phoenix.
He also stood next to the president and said how much he worships and adores the second and third generation Mexicans who are living in America and their contribution to the country, which...
Yeah, many of whom are here not... Go ahead,
legally,
Steve.
But I guess that applies to everyone except the federal judge hearing his case about Trump University.
Well, and here's the thing. A lot of the people who are here illegally have just simply overstayed their visas. I mean, you don't have... it's not a huge part of this problem that you have people who are walking across this border, who are going where the fence ought to go. I mean, it is a problem. It exists. But the actual, if you look at the statistics since 2009, the net migration has been more toward Mexico than into the United States. That it's kind of a net zero sort of thing right now. $150 billion we get to build this wall, would have gross environmental impacts. I just don't think the return on that investment is what could be justified. And you're never going to get Mexico to pay for it. I mean, that's just crazy. So,
oh, yes, you are. I mean, you will. You've got to talk tough to him.
Are you ready?
I mean, what will happen if, God forbid, Trump is elected, is he will say, well, we're going to make this this is going to be a symbolic wall, and we're not going to actually build this
No,
thing.
That's not what he was campaigning on.
No,
he never used the S word.
But no,
symbolic.
No. But how, you can't, he's not going to be able to do. He's not going to be able to find funding for that. The Republicans.
No, if he's president, I'm going to hold him to that. And by the way, I want him to declare that no Trump companies will be involved in this billion-dollar boondoggle. Because how fortunate for him if that happens to happen. And I've never heard anybody ask him that. Will you sort of put your operations in a blind trust or agree that your operations will not profit from your policies, Mr. Businessman? I haven't heard him address that yet.
But look, you know, I think that if you listen to that speech, you listen to what his base wanted to hear, his base heard what it wanted to hear. And the real question is, did moderate voters or swing voters or independent voters, did they hear anything that they could resonate with in that speech? And I think that when they heard, we're not going to be throwing out, you know, the people who are here, law-abiding citizens who are here. We're not going to go and round them up and get a deportation task force and do it. If they heard that, because he did say it, but if they heard it in the midst of all that other thunder that he was hurling, if they heard that, then they heard something that might have persuaded them that he's not completely crazy about immigration. And that, in that sense, the speech probably got the job done for him.
One last thing about this. Steve, how do you explain how close the numbers are?
I don't know if they are that close. I know there was a poll coming out showing it was tightening. It's going to
the
naturally
ABC
tighten.
ABC WAPO poll had them in. You know,
but wasn't there,
Fox News has her up 2 points.
2 points? I thought there was another one with her up 7 points, 6 points. I thought that was a Fox poll. Anyway, yeah. I was reading on Politico today where they're looking at the electoral map, and there are four or five different paths for her to victory, and they're already, although they don't want to say it, and they don't want others to say it, but they're looking at an electoral landslide.
Really?
I mean, there are so many different ways, and you know they're making him now spend what money he has in states that usually are red, Georgia and Arizona, that this thing is going to be a blowout.
Here's the thing that fascinates me about this campaign is that Trump does not have a classic organization. He's not running a normal campaign. And part of the brilliance of a normal campaign and what the Obama campaign was and a lot of the Republican campaigns in the past have been is it's about this ground game. It's not just the people who answer the phone and go, yeah, I'll vote for Trump or yeah, I'll vote for Hillary Clinton. It's getting them to the polls. It's identifying your voters. It's going to their door and knocking on the door, making sure they vote absentee or they vote early or they get there on election day. That is really part of, you know, the quote-unquote political machine that we all talk about. That is a key part of presidential races. And so when you have – so these polls aren't reflecting the fact that Clinton has been building this apparatus for years and has a much more sophisticated get-out-the-vote
and
effort.
And Trump has – I mean, there's some states where he's got just a couple field offices.
He's got
right?
like a 12-year – literally a 12-year-old running his campaign in Colorado, I think. So
that's,
I mean,
so sweet.
So you have that imbalance. And I think that the polls aren't reflecting that. Obviously what's going on with the polls right now is that people don't like and don't trust Hillary Clinton. And we're seeing this drip, drip, drip stuff about the emails and the foundation. And then people keep talking about Benghazi. And she's been unable to get out in front of that or change that narrative. And partly because she's kind of gone into hiding. Where's she been? I don't think
I'll tell you where she's been. She's been raising $150 million. Okay, well, that's what they brought in August.
Yeah, boy, that was unbelievable.
And it may have been smart because people are, you know, there's the classic thing.
She got it from the Clinton Foundation, by the way, Steve. She just took it right out of there.
Is the campaign doesn't start until Labor Day. I don't think that's necessarily as true as it used to be, but there is a sense that when kids are back to school, let's pay attention.
Yeah.
Who are these people yammering at us and wanting our votes?
Can I ask one question? I'm sorry Kristen's not here, but you know...
I'll speak for her.
Okay, right. You talked, Eric, about the foundation last week, and you brought up something to compare and contrast the giving to the foundation to giving to a political campaign. Why is it that it is acceptable for Bill Clinton to go out and raise untold millions of from people anonymously to give to these pro-Hillary PACs, but not okay for him to raise money for charity to help people around the world? I don't understand why we can criticize one without the other. You know what I'm saying? And it's a sincere question. I'm not sure why we're coming down so hard on the foundation when people can do it perfectly legally when it comes to political campaigns, when that clearly is for access and results.
Sure.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, and find me a politician out there, a major politician who hasn't raised a lot of money, who hasn't prioritized meetings with his
right.
high-rolling donors. The question that has to get asked is, okay, what gets done? What has gotten done for... you know, by Hillary Clinton.
But it's this. But
what official act has she taken in response to these donations that you could plausibly say is a quid pro quo? Because the rest of it is just, it's just politics the way it's played by everybody.
It's just
everybody.
Kind of surprising to me that, you know, it's legal, it's approved by the Supreme Court that you can give whatever you want anonymously to these companies or to these PACs. And there's no outrage there, but there is.
Well, there's outrage about it, but
I mean, it's not costing anyone. I mean, I understand what the foreign government's there, but otherwise, it's kind of a mystery to me.
Yeah, you think Donald Trump is getting when he gets big donations that he's not prioritizing meetings and get-togethers with
or Harry Reid or Mitch McConnell?
Oh, any of them.
It's the way it's
any
done,
of them.
And it's
any
legal and it's okay. So,
well,
why
when
is
we
it
had this conversation.
For the
When we had this conversation last week, I was thinking about the amount of money that law firms give to Lisa Madigan. I mean, really, do you think there's any chance that Lisa Madigan's going to lose the next election? And yet they give a lot of money to her. She has a pretty healthy campaign war chest. And I've often thought, golly, that's so interesting to me. I don't say golly to myself, but you get the point. Why are they giving all of that money to Lisa Madigan's campaign? And some of them aren't politically aligned with her, but why would they be doing that? She's going to get elected. Why do they give money to Lisa Madigan's campaign? Law firms.
It's a great question, John. It is a... perfectly relevant, great, terrific question that almost never gets asked. And I don't want to talk about just Lisa Madigan. Why do people give money to Bruce Rauner? Why do they give money to George Bush? Why are they giving money to Donald Trump? You know, I don't understand the impulse to give huge amounts of money to political candidates if you honestly expect nothing in return.
Right.
And I follow the Trump campaign, and so they are always texting to me. And here's the last text I got. And you know, listen, Hillary made a zillion dollars last month, so I'm just bringing this up because it's interesting the sort of tactics they go to. Here's the text. It says, I'll send you a free personal thank you gift if you give $45 or more before the deadline at 11:59. We will stop illegal immigration. So I get a free gift if I make a donation. And then there are a lot of them that pledge that he'll match if we get to a certain amount. Like if we raise $1 million today, I will write a $1 million check of my own. And he's often doing that, asking his followers, if you all give enough, then I'll match that donation. I've never heard that tactic before. I'm not exactly sure what to think about that.
Well, I don't know. The Clintons opened up the Lincoln bedroom in the 90s, so.
Yeah, fair enough.
That was for fundraising.
It just seems to me like if you really believe in a Donald Trump, throw your $1 million in there. I thought you were going to do it to begin with.
The question that Steve brings up, though, is why do we consider it to be okay when in a political context? But when you have this charitable context where the money is actually going for good things,
when you're feeding babies.
You're not making mailers and bumper stickers and funding robocalls.
The
but
very
you're actually
what was the Tribune's policy on this? What is your editorial board say about that? The Clinton Foundation, should they shut it down? Should the Clintons divorce themselves from it?
I don't know that we've taken a position on that.
Well, the very liberal Minneapolis Star Tribune said shut it down, literally shut it down. Talked to the lady the other day, broke my heart, because she's a smart, she's an Eric Zorn, she's a Mary Smeek, she's a Kristen McQuarrie, you know, she's a bright, engaged person. And to the person, the editorial board felt that they need to shut that down. They don't want Donna Shalala running it. They certainly don't want Chelsea running it. And if they can, you know, reinvent it somehow with the remaining money, fine. But that thing has to go away completely.
Well, I said this last week. I think that they ought to fold it into a different something like the Gates Foundation. Just, you know, fold it in, and they should remove their names from it, and they should remove themselves from the oversight of it. And, you know. Until or unless Hillary Clinton is out of the White House.
But it is an interesting thing, because I'm trying to think back, you know, maybe Mitt Romney, I guess, would have qualified this way, of a candidate for president who is so involved in business as Trump is. You know, usually it's politicians who have investments or whatever, but not an active business. So what does Donald Trump do if he wins? Do we finally get those letters off the building here? I don't think so. Trump Tower?
I think you go, I mean, a lot of stuff goes into blind trusts, right? I mean, that's
amazing. But these are active businesses with his name on them. You know, it's not like they're investments in stocks or mutual funds or...
Foot traffic is really down at them, too. Did I mention that in any of these previous podcasts to you guys? There's an app that tracks where people go. You know, it sort of like follows your GPS, and so you can tell where the cool stores are or hip bars are based on foot traffic from people. And at the golf courses and clubs that Trump runs compared to the other ones in those neighborhoods, it's off 17% as of, say, a month ago. When the golf season was peaking this summer, everybody else was having a boom time, and Trump properties were not, for what it's worth. You know, Trump is shooting his business interest in the foot with his political campaign. I don't suppose he cares. He can manage that, but it's not been good for the brand. Guys, we wanted to talk a little bit about the crime in Chicago, and we've eaten up a lot of time here. But Eric, just so that we don't dismiss something that important, just bring it up for us and tell us what you think about this terrible, terrible year and summer.
Well, we just passed, by the time anyone listens to this podcast, we will certainly pass the number of murders in 2016 that we had in all of 2015. And so and August was the most violent August in
20 years, I think, decades.
More than 20 years that we've had. So we've got a real problem that I don't think has been adequately diagnosed. I can't put my finger on exactly what the problem is this year that's making it so much worse than last year. We can look at a lot of these factors that go into, you know, urban violence, and with the excess numbers of guns and the gangs splintering the way they've been splintering, so that you have like rival factions of these formerly large gangs shooting at each other on various street corners. But all those trends have been going on for years. I don't know what about this year has made things worse. I mean, the one effect that people talk about is, you know, the so-called Ferguson effect, where police are pulling back, and they're just doing it in ways that we can't really quite measure, we can't really quite see, but the measurement is the number of people who are being killed.
And here we are at Labor Day, where the police union is telling rank and file to bypass requests for overtime, which I guess I didn't think of, but that lends a little credence to that, doesn't it, Eric?
It does, and I did a piece earlier this week about something that was reported last weekend in the Tribune. Megan Crapeau, one of our overnight cop reporters, was on the scene of a shooting down at 71st and Polina, and the police were there for an hour trying to, you know, gather evidence about another one of these shootings, and they were being taunted by kids in the neighborhood. They're yelling.
Yeah, I saw that
and
picture.
You see the video yeah. too of these, and the stuff that they were saying to the police officers. And so there is this other side to the
right.
story, which is that these police officers are trying to maintain law and order in these communities that are so hostile to them. And you can imagine what that does to you as an officer. We're thinking like, you know, like, am I going to really go the extra mile here? Am I going to run down a dark alley in order to save somebody's life, somebody who has just been, you know, taunting me and hates me? And I can see where psychologically where that kind of thing would make a difference. I don't know if it makes a difference, you know, hundreds of murders more difference, but so some things that have been happening this week on John Cass's podcast, on this very podcast network, Eddie Johnson, the police superintendent said that he wants a special session of the legislature to be called in order to pass they got to introduce and pass sentencing requirements for gun crimes. That you've got these people who are picked up again and again for gun crime violations who are cycled through and cycled out, and I guess these guys who shot and killed Dwayne Wade's cousin.
Just out, right? One of them?
Yeah, and we're imprisoning too many people for nonviolent crimes, and we're not locking up for long enough the people who are...
Well, I saw the statistic, Harry, and it had the number of shootings and how you could distill it down to a very small number of people. I think that's the way I saw it, that, you know, we have this problem of crime in a city of, 6-8 million people, but really it's just a handful of people that are doing it. To me, you either go one way or the other. I suggested not that long ago, maybe they just ought to just say, throw up their hands and walk away. Say, fine, you don't want us in the neighborhood? Have at it. You guys, you figure it out.
Well, they're not going to do that, but
then do the other extreme, Eric. Then put two cops on every street corner from 10P to 6A.
Well,
street corner. They could wave to each other.
Another thing that's happened is that Mayor Emanuel has announced his determination to hire more police officers, which I think is overdue. They've been having these police officers work a lot of overtime, and they're probably getting a little ragged, a lot of them.
Yeah.
There's that kind of thing. Governor Rauner rejected the idea of calling out the National Guard, and I think that's smart on his part.
Really? How about you, Steve?
National Guard is not trained.
I don't think that's good. I think that would add fuel to the fire, really.
And they're not trained for that.
We need a solution, not a, you know, that would be maybe a Band-Aid that would cause more injury underneath the bandage.
This is the Friday of the Labor Day weekend, guys. Rather than a recommendation this week, let's close the podcast with best job, worst job you ever had. Anybody want to go first? You can't say the job you have now. Actually, you can.
I'll go first. The worst job I ever had was delivering newspapers. I delivered the Ann Arbor News, and the reason it was a bad job is because it didn't pay very well. And you had to go around and collect money from people.
Yeah, I hate that.
That was the worst part of it, was having to go door to door in the evening. You'd go and deliver the paper, and then you'd have to go into these houses. People aren't ready for you to get there, and it was just a difficult job. It wasn't horrible, but it was a difficult job and didn't pay very well. And, you know, I mean, I know it sounds corny, but the best job I've ever had is the job I've got right now, which is a podcast member. No,
it's not that funny.
I don't want to be corny about this, but being able to write a column for a newspaper is an opportunity and a privilege, and it's a great job. I love it. So,
worst job I ever had was I used to clean the meat room of an Eagle supermarket. So I would go in there at night and clean up after the butchers would leave scraps of ground beef everywhere and sawdust, and they'd use a power washer and had to wear special clothes because they were ruined after the cleaning. Best job, me too. I've been here at WGN for over 30 years and have done different things. There have certainly been not great times, but, you know, thinking of it, back in the late 80s and 90s, I used to travel with Chicago Bears. I'd interview Mike Ditka after football games, I'd travel on the team plane. And I was in my 20s at the time and just thought stuff like that would last forever. But I think that probably was the most fun I had.
Let's add another wrinkle to this question, which is, what's the best job you've had besides this working here?
Well, you want to layer on that, Eric?
I want to layer on because I think that all of us are in jobs right now that we really enjoy.
Well, the other cool thing for me was I used to I hosted a show, an online show called Meet the Writers for BarnesandNoble.com.
Yeah, that wasn't that long ago.
No, so I've interviewed hundreds of writers, from Stephen King to...
Oh, the very best, to some obscure ones.
Just a wonderful experience.
And my best job besides newspapers was I used to wash dishes in the dorm cafeteria at Michigan. And we used to sing. We had laminated song sheets, and the whole line of dishwashers, we would sing old songs together really loud while we were washing dishes. So that was a great time. So anyway,
wow,
your turn, Johnny.
Worst job for me was sludge pump operator. You know those municipal pools they have where they send all of the sewage? That has to be coagulated, and there was a problem with the collection ponds. And my job was to get a fire hose, hook it up to a pump, and then drag the hose through the muck.
Okay, that beats cleaning meat out of a bunker.
Yeah, that's not bad.
It was amazing. I did that for a summer. My best job ever was the same job because it paid really well. I was independent, and it was my first real, like, not job as a busboy. I couldn't believe that they were, you know, let me hang out at this place all by myself. I'd pack a lunch. I'd take a long, hour-long lunch and read. I was 17. I was 18. It didn't matter. It didn't matter.
You work up an appetite moving to lunch.
I did. I was 18. I didn't care. And, well, some terrible things happened that summer that I won't share with you. I thought it was really cool to be making money on my own, and it felt that way for the first time. So that's my best job. And that's the Mincing Rascals. You can hear this podcast broadcast in part Saturdays on my show at 1:30 here on WGN. Thank you, Eric Zorn and Steve Bertrand. Kristen McQuarrie pledges to rejoin us soon. And thanks to our producer, Kristen Decker, and engineer Bob Ferguson. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. You can also listen online on the WGN Plus app or WGNplus.com. The Mincing Rascals podcast is a presentation of the WGN Plus podcast network. You can also catch highlights every Saturday from 1:30 to 2 p.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.
You little rascal, you!